you know. But if you tune in tomorrow morning, why don't you listen to the conversation Charles Blow had with Khalil Muhammad, the director of the Schomburg Center for Black Research, and then pledge for the book. It's something that always, you know, the human condition is something that's always interesting. And Charles Blow personifies this, the glory of the human spirit. 212-209-2950. That's the number to call. We have about 3 minutes left, folks, and we want to knock this out. I have no idea how much money we've gotten or will get, or there's no thermometer here. There's no financial thermometer that I can see readily. But we know that you have been supporting again. Wanted to thank Michelle, Bridget, Don, Patricia, Robert, Stephen, Leafy, Brian, and all those folks from the People's Republic of Brooklyn, from Queens, from upstate New York and Long Island and Somerset, New Jersey. Thank you all for your contributions to this radio station. We appreciate that. We want to continue to we as a radio station want to continue to be a part of the New York City and national landscape, a radio landscape. 212-209-2950. Visa, MasterCard, American Express. Those are the plastics that we take. Again, electronics, funds, transfers we take. The buddy plan we take. What is it? Web2Go? What is it? Not Web2Go, but...
Give to WBAI.
Excuse me, folks.
Give to WBAI.org. Again, a safety pledge to community radio, and you can do it pretty quickly online. And check out what many gifts are available for those of you who do pledge. But I really urge you to forget that. Bypass the whole gift thing, the whole premium thing, and just show that you're committed to do your love, send your love to community radio, to WBAI. Community radio has a long tradition all around the world, and I've gone to so many places, particularly in Latin America, but I've been to Australia, I've been to India, I've been to throughout Europe, and people, when they talk about community radio, somehow WBAI gets into the conversation, not only because I'm part of it, but because people know and recognize the long trajectory, the cultural, political, social trajectory of WBAI over 55 years, and Pacifica for even more, for over 60 years as the Pacifica Foundation and Network. So people know all around the world and look to WBAI and to Pacifica as an example of what community radio can and could be. And we're asking you to be a part of that, to show that you support that effort that is done here 24/7 now since 1960. 212-209-2950. We do have a lot of people to thank. Iris calling in from East Harlem. Thank you for that call, perhaps very close to the studios there at WBAI, WHCR. We want to thank Ben, also in Midtown Manhattan, for your pledge of support to community radio. Thank you so much for that. Pamela in Brooklyn, nice call. Thank you so much for your support to WBAI. Christy, another call from Brooklyn. Thanks for your pledge of support. And Rachel from Brooklyn. Wow, it seems like a lot of folks from Brooklyn are calling in for the Schomburg tapes. Thank you so much for all that support and all those...
By the way, if you're tuning in for Hour of the Wolf, this show's running over, and we're going to let it run over because the fundraising is important. But I'm here. We'll be on shortly.
Letters in politics, and we should be going to that in a moment. Let's see if we can get a last-minute flurry.
212-209-2950.
But I want to thank you once again, Dred Scott Keyes. We'll be listening tomorrow on the morning show with Michael G. Haskins. And then I know we have a lot of other interesting programs that you have cooking up for the WBAI audience in the coming days. So thank you so much, Michael G. Dred Scott Keyes. Thank you, Reggie Johnson. I'm so used to being on the air with this guy.
I know. It's all good.
Sometimes I hate to say it, but sometimes I get into autopilot and then yeah. I just start, you know. So I hope that's
no,
not
man, you're just crazy. That's all.
Question. Well, you know it. I'm on sabbatical. So
yes, and you're the program director at WBAI. Yeah,
there has to be something, a couple of screws loose to make that decision. But anyway, thank you all.
Well, thank you, Mario, for joining us this afternoon.
And again, keep calling in 212-209-2950.
Again, thank you to all who have pledged. We want to thank you all for your donations to this radio station and helping to keep it alive, of course. Tomorrow morning, we will be discussing Charles Blow, and his new book, Fire Shut Up in My Bones. And again, thanks everyone. Thank you, Reggie, for your engineering of this program. And thanks to Michael G. All right, thank you. Dred Scott Keys is out.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. Well, for the time being at least during the remainder of this thon, I'm starting at 1 a.m. or thereabouts. And we're going to do our annual Samhain show. However, you're not off the hook for pledging. Isn't that scary? Like they were saying before, 212-209-2950, or go to WBAI.org and pledge there. Oh yeah, don't forget, the name of the show you want to pledge is Our Lord.
Halloween, 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 Halloween. we call home. Everyone hail to the pumpkin soul.
In this town, don't we love it now? Everybody's waiting for the next surprise.
One that corner man hiding in the trash can. Something's waiting by the bounce and how you scream.
This is Halloween.
Red and black.
And slightly green.
Aren't you scared?
Well, that's just fine.
Say it once, say it twice. Take a chance and roll the dice.
Ride with the moon in the dead of night.
Everybody scream. Everybody scream.
Shadow on the moon at night, filling your dreams to the brim with fright.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween. Halloween, 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 Halloween,
Halloween, Halloween, Halloween.
Jingle pumpkins everywhere. Life's no fun without a good scare.
That's our job,
but we're not here
in our town of Halloween.
In this town,
don't we love it now?
Everyone's waiting for the next surprise.
Stick it to Jack, might catch you in the back and
scream like a banshee, make you jump out of your skin.
This is Halloween, everybody scream.
Won't you please make way for every special guy?
The Mallman Jack is king of the pumpkin patch. Everyone hails in the pumpkin king.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween.
Halloween, 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 Hallo
we have to make sure that WBAI lives forever, which is why you're going to pick up the phone right now in a state of, well, All Hallows Eve fear, or perhaps Samhain Blessed Be Spirit, and dial 212-209-2950 and pledge $10 a month. Become a WBAI buddy and get the nifties that they've got. You get a couple of thumb drives with that that include 100 different speakers from the WBAI/Pacifica selections. And that's for $10 a month and an ongoing way to support the station. So it's 212-209-2950. Or if you care to do it online, just go to WBAI.org and follow the links that ask you to donate. And when it asks you to list your favorite show, why not list Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor, as I've liked to say through the years. A little history, if you don't know, Hour of the Wolf began on this radio station in 1972, hosted by Margot Adler, Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 a.m. And at one point, Margot went away. I am told it was 73. My memory is that it was 74, and I took over the show for like 6 weeks. But I know I didn't take over the show on a regular basis till 74, so I'm piecing this together, that Margot must have come back for a while, and I was her co-host on Thursdays and Fridays. That was true from the beginning. And we, after a while, she left to do different time slots here on BAI, including a morning show and a midnight show for a while, and then settling in into Monday nights from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. And after a while, she left that, and I took that over, and then all of a sudden, the program director realized that I had, like, three shows going at once and cut me down to one. And the one that I chose to continue was Hour of the Wolf, which was on Saturday mornings. Steve Erickson, as program director, moved me kicking and screaming to Saturdays 5 to 7 a.m., but it turned out to be probably the best time slot I ever had. And, ooh, almost exactly, is it 3 years ago now or four? I got sort of canceled by interim program director Tony Bates, and he had promised me greater things to come. And in about 3 weeks later, through negotiation with Robert Knight and by moving another show out, I was moved from 1:30 till 3 a.m., which, yeah, isn't the same. I loved 5 to 7 a.m., which is the actual Hour of the Wolf, the twilight time between night and dawn, which in Sweden, where Vargatimen, Hour of the Wolf, begins, can last, you know, a long time. At the best of times, the twilight is like half an hour, and at certain times of the year can be up to 2 or 3 hours. The twilight all the way north there. So Hour of the Wolf, which is named after a movie by Ingmar Bergman, 1967 film, or 69, sorry, 69 film. Interesting movie. So that's a little history of this program. And the fact that WBAI can host a program dedicated to science fiction and fantasy, and this was not new. When I came here and Margot came here with plans to do speculative fiction on the air, this, we were preceded by Baird Searles, who had on his coterie of staff, Samuel R. Delaney and Joanna Russ and Theodore Sturgeon and Thomas M. Dish, and dropping in would be folk like Harlan Ellison and Neil Conan, late of NPR, was a regular on Baird's show of Unicorns and Universes, and occasionally made appearances on Hour of the Wolf with Margot on Mondays. In fact, at least once or twice I remember hearing him, and talking science fiction, no small amount. So, a bit of background there, and just ask yourself, what kind of radio station is willing to have a program dedicated to serious, and sometimes not so serious, literature of science fiction and fantasy? And admittedly, this month of October, we have been doing mostly media, mostly movies and stuff like that, because that goes well with pitching and fundraising drive. And just what tonight's show is going to be, you know what? I don't yet know, which is one of the beauties and perhaps setbacks, but I like to think of it as a great thing involving freeform radio. And there you go. Certainly there may be another science fiction radio program or two left in the country, but I dare say none of them are freeform radio with the ability to bring in people from the New York market, where we get writers all the time, some of the best in the world, and some of the up-and-coming, to read to you and then having you talk to them over the phone about the stories that you have just heard. Speaking of writers reading stories, we have an event this coming Tuesday, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. That's our monthly series, my monthly series anyway, named after the magazine, the New York Review of Science Fiction, but at this point pretty much independent, actually has been for most of its 24 years. And we're going to have horror reading for you. And since I am not quite so much into certain kinds of horror, I asked Amy Goldschlager, who's a former curator of the reading series, to come up with our performers, and she came up with two doozies, being John Langan and Nicholas Kaufman. And let me tell you about them. Nick Kaufman is the Bram Stoker / Shirley Jackson / and Thriller Award-nominated writer of General Slocum's Gold, Chasing the Dragon, Hunt at World's End, Still Life, 9 stories, Dying is My Business, and Die and Stay Dead. Not bad, but stay dead. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, and you can visit him online at Nicholas Kaufman, NICHOLASKAUFMANN. That's the trick. 2 N's, 1 F. .com. And John Langan, whose most recent collection of fiction, The Wide Coniferous Sky and Other Monstrous Geographies, was recently published by Hippocampus Press. He is the author of a previous collection, Mr. Gaunt and Other Uneasy Encounters, and a novel, House of Windows. With Paul Tremblay, he co-edited Creatures, 30 Years of Monsters. His recent fiction has appeared in venues including Ellen Datlow's Fearful Symmetries and Ross Lockhart and Justin Steele's Children of Old Leech. He teaches courses in creative writing and the Gothic tradition at State University of New York in New Paltz, and he lives in the Hudson Valley with his wife, younger son, and more animals than he has time to name or we have time to talk about. And Amy Goldschlager, who will be running the event, I will host the beginning, but Amy is running it. She writes the audiobook column for Locus, and she has also written audiobook reviews for Publishers Weekly, Audiophile magazine, and has contributed genre fiction reviews and features to Kirkus, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and Comic Mix. And she lives here in New York City and online at amygoldschlager.com. I better spell that one, too. I never get it right. AmyGold. That's the easy part. Then Schlager. It's not that hard. Gold. Goldschlager. Well, I didn't say that right, but you get the idea. Anyway, that's Election Day, Tuesday, November 4th. Doors open at 6:30. We begin the festivities at 7, but at 6:30 we'll have cider and wine and cheese and all of that good stuff. And this will be taking place at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, otherwise known as Gallery Lala, which is an artisan's market, at 138 Sullivan Street between Houston and Prince. And it will be in the downstairs dungeon or cabaret, depending on how you look at it. So, more information, you can go to ourwolf.com and click the links through to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, or go to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, NYRSF, N-Y-R-S-F, Readings, group page on Facebook, or for that matter, go to the Our Wolf, Hour of the Wolf, not Our Wolf, the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook as well. I'm also on Twitter as Jim Freund, whatever. However you get there, show up. Admission is free, by the way. I didn't mention that. We do hawk people for donations, but it's free. So please come by no matter what. And listen to these two wonderful writers read. Next month, by the way, December, it's really 2 months from now, 5 weeks from now, our readers will be Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman. And that will be held at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Is that a familiar address? Well, it should be. WBAI, our management office, which you're going to support, right, by calling 212-209-2950, is on the third floor of that building. But the ground floor of that building, which, by the way, is wheelchair accessible, is a wonderful venue and will be there on December 2nd. So we were there once before with Walter Mosley and Paul DiFilippo, and hope that you will join us for Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner. God, I have a cold, okay? I have a cold. So right now I seem to be able to talk, but the brain is slushy. So what can I say? So this is a free-form program. I was close to having a guest, but that did not work out. And there are a few ways we can go. I think next week we're going to have to finish up our media month with the program examining the eighth season of Doctor Who, the first Peter Capaldi season, because I am quite the Whovian, and I know that I had Tempest Bradford on the air last week, and she and I degenerated into discussing and criticizing Who somewhat, but she has not been following this season, and I want to get into talking about this season, probably with Terrence Taylor and possibly some other folk, make a panel out of it. So, be sure to be here next week, but if we take phone calls later on this morning, perhaps we'll go there. Now, I could do a reading. And since I have had and will have Shirley Jackson Award-winning writer Sam J. Miller on the air, and am planning on having Shirley Jackson Award-winning writer Veronica Shaness on the air. She was actually scheduled twice in September, but various things, including her having a nasty health, not serious, but nasty enough to keep her off the air situation, didn't work out. So we're going to record a program in early November. So I was thinking, last year I read the story Shuttlebop by Theodore Sturgeon, which may be the third time I've read that on the air on our Samhain / All Hallows Eve program. And it's a wonderful ghost story, a very well done one. But not twice in a row. It's also a very long story. And given my cold, I'm not going to tempt fate. However, one possibility is if I can manage it with this cold, why not read not just a, but the Shirley Jackson horror story? And that is, of course, The Lottery. Yes, she wrote, now I'm forgetting the entire name. The movie, of course, is The Haunting. It's The Haunting of Hell House? Hill House? It's The Haunting. And that's a short novel. And any number of other weird tales that have redefined American horror in so many ways that the award is properly named after her. But The Lottery is for me. It has no supernatural act within it. But at the end of the story, and there's no gore, there's no ripping of limbs or anything like that, something I disdain, one of the reasons I tend to shy away from a lot of horror. But at the end of the story, you are left with a lovely feeling of dread. Or, I've played this on the air a few times, but I can't help but think of Hour of the Wolf and Samhain without thinking of Margot Adler. And we have her lecture on why we love vampires. And this is a week very important to all of us who cherish and love Margot Adler. There will be a remembrance of her this week. And we could hear that, and I've played it several times since her death at age 67, just about 3 months ago, and I'm still horrified by it. Margot was, to me, very much an older sister. I knew her well since I was 13, and scantily, an argument can be made, and she and I weren't sure, but apocryphally, at the very least, and very possibly totally true, since I was before the age of one and she was about the age of seven. But certainly we were production partners here at WBAI from about 1967, well, it was really 68. 67, I was just answering phones, but we met in 67 at the station and embarked together on Hour of the Wolf in 72 and worked together till through the early 80s when about 1983, I think it was, she had been working at NPR since NPR's conception. But there came a time when NPR decided that she should not be moonlighting, working both for Pacifica Radio and National Public Radio. And, well, one paid and the other didn't. So we could just take phone calls. I could play a music mix. I don't have a CD collection with me, but I have access to music legally through the internet. I subscribe to a service that gives me all the music I can eat. And there's tons and tons of Halloween songs in my repertoire. And and the Shirley Jackson and or the Margot Adler lecture. And you know what? I'm going to ask you to help me decide. Give me a call at 212-209-2900 and tell me if you have a preference. And we'll take your calls on the air just for a couple of minutes. And I ask you to be on topic. Or another option, as I mentioned, is discussing Whoville. And I don't mean as in Horton Hears a Who. 212-209-2900. Let me get this right. Hello? Hi there, you're on the air. Hello? Oop. Yeah, I've got the buttons pressed, but I'm not hearing you. Let's try this. Hello, you're on the air.
A Few Ballads of the Season and Margot's Vampires.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, that's a good possibility. Anybody else? 212-209-2900. And don't forget, 212-209-2950. Just add 50 to that 2900 and pledge 50 to keep WBAI alive in the name of Howard the Wolf. Very, very, very important. This is a critical time. I'm very pleased, by the way, that we have, if only interim, at least we have a bona fide program director, one experienced with WBAI on hand, Mario Murillo. And it is a good thing, let me tell you. I'm hoping to up the ante on what it is I do here. But, you know, regardless, change must come. And change will come. Of course, that's how I sort of lost 5 to 7 a.m., was because I agreed with the idea of change. I could have fought and kept that slot. But I thought that that program director was going to stay around. Okay, no other takers? Well, I think that we may just do exactly what the last caller said and go into Margot's lecture on why we love vampires. And from there, we'll have some music. Sound good to you? Well, I hope it will sound good. I promise you it will sound good. With those people in hand, how can it not? Well, that depends on our equipment working. Come on. I've double-clicked you. Yes. I see you on the player, but I don't see you playing. Ah! Human error. My fault. Hit that button and start it again. Hi, Margot.
Vampires. I was never interested in vampires. If you asked me 5 years ago, I would have said, "Are you kidding?" I'd read maybe one vampire novel, not the 250 I have read now. I had seen one movie, The Hunger, probably because I knew the author. But going to a conference, I bought some trashy novels for the plane. I read the two Twilight novels, and it might have ended right there. But 8 days later, my husband was diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer. I started obsessing on vampire novels, sitting by his bedside while he slept, because I was thinking about mortality. My husband and partner of 33 years was dying, and he was someone who wanted to live forever. There was a definite tension between our views on death, a tension I didn't really understand until after he died. It's also a tension I realize now that exists in many of the most interesting vampire novels. My husband had what I would call the high-tech view of death. It was to be avoided at all costs. He was a runner. He was in perfect health. He took various supplements and antioxidants. He drank a glass of wine for resveratrol. He never smoked. He was fit. And unlike me, he never did any drugs in his youth. He thought he would live to be 100 or preferably even older. And a science journalist, he followed scientific discoveries and all the advances of aging research. And when he did die, he thought, he might have his ashes flown up in space. His attitude was definitely rage, rage, rage against the dying of the light. I, at that same moment, had more of an earth-centered pagan perspective. We're all part of the life cycle, like a seed. We are born, we sprout, we grow, we mature, we decay, we make room for future generations who, like seedlings, are reborn through us. As for the persistence of consciousness, deep down I thought, how can we know? Perhaps we simply return to the elements. We become earth and air and fire and water. That seemed okay to me. In fact, I remember reading in a book by the feminist author Barbara Walker that the ancient meaning of the four elements was the way we went to die. We were left for carrion in the air, we were buried in the earth, we were burned on the pyre, and we were buried in the depths of the sea. That also seemed all right. Although deep down, there was a part of me that was on my husband's wavelength and wanted to live forever. The vampire of myth and literature embodies some of that same tension my husband and I had regarding death. They have near immortality and yet are tragically frozen in time. They cannot grow and change like the seasons or, in most descriptions, birth new life. And yet they have superpowers and strength and often the wisdom that can come with extreme age, an often cynical, jaundiced view of life. Rosalie, who bemoans her frozen state in the Twilight novels, is asking the same question asked in books like Tuck Everlasting or Olaf Stapleton's famous science fiction novel from 1930, Last and First Men. Humans want to be part of nature, yet we still want to push the edge of the envelope, seeking to be more. Vampires let us play with death and the issue of mortality. They let us ponder what it would mean to be truly long-lived. They allow us to ask questions we usually bury except in science fiction. What does one value more and what does one value less with a short human life? Is the vampire's frozen life sterile? Does life only mean something when it's part of a cycle of birth, growth, decay, death, and the birth of new life? Is there a beauty that comes only from the cycles of the season which we are part? So in the beginning, I pondered mortality, but I knew it didn't explain the millions of readers and movie viewers and television watchers who were devouring vampire stories. An article in The Hollywood Reporter a year or so ago said, vampires brought in $7 billion to the Hollywood economy in the last 2 years, the GDP of a small nation. 117 million Twilight books have been sold the last time I looked. And this is not just a teen phenomena. There are at least 30,000 adult women on a Twilight Moms website. New vampire novels continue to be constant bestsellers for adults and teens. And on television, there's The Vampire Diaries, True Blood, and both the American and British versions of Being Human. On a recent trip to Europe, I found that my Dutch teenage relatives in Amsterdam and the 20-year-olds at a conference I spoke to at Edinburgh were absolutely obsessed with The Vampire Diaries. I wanted to understand why vampires have such pull, such popularity, such traction in our culture, both in American and much European culture at this very moment in time. It's very easy to dismiss all this pop culture snidely and to say, for example, oh, it's all about teens and sex or even repressed sex. You've read the articles, how Twilight is all about abstinence from a Mormon point of view and Edward's a stalker. I don't believe it for a minute. We all now know that rape is not about sex. It's about power. I began to wonder if maybe the interest in vampires was really a meditation on power and its abuses. One of the reasons that vampires are interesting is that they, like we, are in conflict over issues of power. We want it, we distrust it, we get twisted by it, we abuse it, we love it, we hate it, we struggle with it. Almost every recent vampire novel, film, and television show confronts this issue. Amy Smith, a Quaker who teaches courses on the literature of war, and also on vampire films and fiction at the University of the Pacific, puts it this way. The central question in so many of these films and novels is, if you had power over others, how would you use it? The tension is always between, we're at the top of the food chain, we can do what we want, humans are cattle, they're prey, versus, we were once human, how can we treat humans like cattle? This is the same tension, she says, that we have in life. If you earn more money than someone, if you have more power than someone, how will you use it? Does having more power or status give you the right to use it? Does might make right? It's really the same question, she says. Teens who naturally feel invisible and powerless, since they are still under the thumb of the twin authorities of school and parents, find the fantasy of difference, of special powers and abilities, intoxicating. Whether these powerful creatures are the X-Men, the beings of Pandora, or vampires, they identify with the struggle of wanting power, yet they often see its dangers with clearer eyes than their parents, because they are watching from the outside as the older generation abuses power, often wielding it over them, often seeing their rites of passage as criminal. In an extraordinary email I received from Anne Rice, the author who has sold millions of vampire novels, she said, the vampire, the symbol of the outsider in all of us, is romanticized by teens because they so desperately need to find a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them.
I to pause just for a second to say that I'm going to be doing an interview with Anne Rice somewhere in the next 2 weeks. So get ready to hear her on this program soon.
Hear that again. They so desperately need to find a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. Reading that, I thought of the horrors of consumer culture they must navigate. I thought about high school. Think of the Cullens in Twilight doing high school over and over. Think about doing the senior prom 5 times. Now that's a horror story. And if we look at Buffy, the Vampire Slayer, it's all about power. Women, power, and leadership. In the last season of Buffy, she's forced to renounce patriarchal power and give up her own power for the power of all women. There are hundreds of scholarly articles just about this. And of course, if we look further back, Voltaire, Engels, Marx, the people of Occupy Wall Street, all use the word vampire to describe issues of power, usually using the word for the powerful, the corrupt, the capitalist, the Wall Street trader. Most of the teen vampire stories are not only about power, they're really about choice and identity. Bella, at the end of the third Twilight movie, describes herself as an outsider who feels more at home in an inhuman world than a human one. This is not about you, she says to Edward. This is about me and my choices. But that still doesn't explain what's really going on now. Every age gets the vampire it needs, feminist author Nina Auerbach wrote in her book, Our Vampires Ourselves. Every age uses vampires to express their fears and concerns, writes Eric Newsom in his book, The Dead Travel Fast. In 1897, when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, England had the largest ports in the world. There was fear of incoming disease, of foreigners, of immigration, and Stoker created the perfect monster, Eastern European, bringing dirt from a foreign land. You can do this for every period that has had a wave of interest in vampires. In the 1980s, with AIDS, for example, vampires were often described as parasites. You became infected by vampirism like a disease. And the first vampire novel, story rather, in the English language, was started in 1816 in the same chalet on the same weekend that Mary Shelley started to write Frankenstein. The fear at that time was science replacing God. So what's happening now? Who are the vampires we have created? And what are the fears and concerns they are expressing? Look at our modern vampires, most of those of the last 15 years. The Cullens in Twilight, Bill Compton and Eric Northman in True Blood, Mick St. John in that wonderful CBS one-season series Moonlight, Mitchell, the vampire in the BBC series Being Human, Henry Fitzroy in Blood Ties by Tanya Huff, Stefan and Damon in the television show The Vampire Diaries, and let's not forget Angel and Spike in Buffy. They all have something in common that makes them different than most vampires that went before. When I put their names in a line on a piece of paper, it was like a light bulb suddenly went off. Unlike the vampires that went before, they're all struggling desperately to be moral, despite being predators. Often failing, sometimes succeeding, but all engaged in a profound struggle to lead a moral life despite their need for blood. There's a wonderful scene in the presidential vampire thriller Blood Oath by Christopher Farnsworth, which came out a couple years ago. The idea is that President Andrew Johnson found a vampire on a ship and imprisoned him. He managed to get Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen of New Orleans, to bind him by a blood oath to serve every president of the United States. Nathaniel Cade, the vampire, is now in the modern world serving a president somewhat like Obama. In one scene, he stands in the back of an AA meeting. He does this pretty regularly because he sees himself as an addict. And while he only drinks animal blood, he still lusts for the blood of humans. We humans are addicts, not only in the obvious ways, abusing alcohol and cigarettes and drugs and food. We are clearly in a struggle with an addictive lifestyle. 8 U.S. presidents in a row have claimed they would bring about the end of our dependence on foreign oil, and they've meant it, just like a smoker means it when he insists he will quit. But our jobs, the economy, the way we live and commute, the way our infrastructure is set up, all compromise us. We depend, at least for now, on continuing an addictive relationship to fossil fuels. Oil is our blood, and our addiction compromises the earth. Vampires are exactly us right now, as we wage wars, use oil, and suck the lifeblood out of the planet. Whitley Strieber, author of The Hunger, goes even further. He says, our prey is the planet. If so, vampires are us, and the issue before us is how we can learn to use our formidable powers without destroying the world and future generations. Like vampires, we are in a struggle with our own predation. You may ask, when did we create this vampire that represents this moral struggle? At first I thought it was Buffy, and then I thought it went back to Anne Rice, but it really goes back 45 years to Dark Shadows and the vampire Barnabas. Dark Shadows started in 1966, but Barnabas didn't appear until well into 67, and the word vampire was never used until 68, and so I started thinking about those years. In 1966, Stuart Brand, the man who founded the Whole Earth Catalog, one of the most significant environmental journals, took an LSD trip on the rooftop of a San Francisco building. He was meditating on something Buckminster Fuller had once said, that the root of man's misbehavior was the notion that our Earth was flat and infinite. On LSD, he suddenly felt and saw the curve of the Earth. When he came down, he printed up a political button and sent a couple hundred all over the world, to NASA, to Soviet and U.S. diplomats, to members of the United Nations and members of Congress. The button had this sentence: why have we not yet seen a picture of the whole Earth? While there were a couple of fuzzy views from satellites, it would take Apollo 8 in 1968 to give us that color picture of the Earth rising. And 4 years later, another Apollo gave us the picture of the blue marble Earth, which may well be the most reproduced photograph in history. Those photographs changed us. At first we saw just no boundaries, and we are all brothers and sisters. But eventually, we understood the darker vision. We saw our vulnerabilities for the first time. We saw ourselves as compromised morally, standing on this fragile planet and not doing what we need to do to save her. 1970 was the first Earth Day, the real beginning of the environmental movement. As we suddenly saw the Earth's fragility, a tiny ball of brilliant color in a dark universe, a ball so small the astronauts could blot it out with their thumb. They all noted it, and we all changed. Our vampires changed at the same moment. This image changed us and our thinking. I think the vampires so many are identifying with allow us to look at ourselves more clearly, to see the compromises we make daily, the moral struggles we often lose or more commonly deny. Sylvia Plath wrote, "I'm terrified of this dark thing that lives in me." And Stephen Moore in The Vampire in Verse writes, "The reason you can't see a vampire in the mirror, the vampire is a mirror, reflecting our secret self." Hopefully, these morally conflicted vampires will allow us not only to see our abuses of power more clearly, but give us a few insights on how we can struggle to live more morally on this earth. And now, when someone says to me, "How could you waste 3 years reading vampire novels?" I paraphrase something that the late great science fiction writer Philip K. Dick once said, that when the divine is exiled from much of our culture, sometimes you have to look for it in the trash. Blessed be.
For a minute, and the birth of jazz you'll hear. And where there is a little jazz, you'll always find me near.
WBAI New York.
I'm a jazz vampire. Shake a foot, shake a foot, shake a foot with me and dance, dance. Dancing is my specialty. Wise men keep bottom away. They know I'll lead them astray. They fall the minute I sway. I insist you can't resist a jazz vampire. Take a tip, take a tip, take a tip from me, for I am all that evil music has. Went down to the river, stood on a bank, shook my shoulders and the boat all sang. For I'm the meanest kind of jazz vampire. I'm the wicked vampire of the jazz. Get up in the morning and I make the coffee roll. Ham and egg turn over, put the crullers in a hole. Get up on a trolley car, the car begins to sway. I sit upon a half a dozen laps to start the day. I walk into the office and I greet the starter there. 6 or 7 elevators go up in the air. Sit down at my Remington and syncopate the keys. The fellow by the water stand gets water on the knees. The boss dictates a letter. "Dear sir, I'd like to say." The man who gets the letter has to stop and hesitate. Now when the day is over and the sun sets in the west, say I'm the only little bird who doesn't go to rest. For I'm a jazz vampire. Take a tip, take a tip, take a tip from me, for I am all the evil music has. I stood by the ocean, no one around. Shook my shoulders and the sun went down. For I'm the meanest kind of jazz vampire. I'm the wicked vampire of the jazz.
soggy silk, well wrought with pearls of Bepiban. So if you will be my lover, so true this goodly gift, you shall command. Alison goes, she must be the happiest witch in the North Country. Alison goes, she must be the happiest witch in the North Country.
Okay, bear with me, people. I had my mix all set up, but I had turned down the volume on the segue that I was going to do, Nasty Nasty. So I am going to go back to the end of Alison Gross so I can do that segue, because on my Samhain show, I will be darned if I don't get to do that. And do it I will. So no, we don't need to hear this whole song from the beginning. Why won't it let me skip forward to near the end? Pardon me for a minute. You see, lowering volumes. This is where I get into trouble, doing two players here on... okay, here we go. About 40 seconds away. Let's try that. Hey, wasn't that segue worth it, folks?
I forbid you maidens all, that's where gold in your hair, to travel to Carter Hall, for young Tamlin is there. And that gold by Carter Hall, but they leave him a pledge, either their mantles of green, or else their maidenhead.
city. And this was seen of King Henry, though he lay quite alone, for he's taken him to a haunted hall 7 miles from the town.
He's chased the deer now, him before, and the doe down by the den, till the fattest buck in all the flock King Henry he is slain. His huntsmen followed him to the hall to make them burly cheer, when loud the wind was heard to sound and an earthquake rocked the floor. And darkness covered all the hall where they sat at their meat. The grey dogs yowling left their food and crept to Henry's feet. And louder howled the roaring wind and burst the fastened door. And in there came a grisly ghost standing on the floor. Her head at the roof tree of the house, a middle year could not span. Each frightened huntsman fled the hall.
He's dead. She looked out of the window as white as any milk, and he looked in at the window as black as any silk.
Hello, 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 you coal blacksmith. You have done me no harm. You never shall have me maidenhead. The dye you kept so long, I'd rather die a maid. Ah, but then she said, be buried all in me grave. That I'm such a nasty, husky, dusky, fusky, musky, coal blacksmith. A maiden I will die.